in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, July 29th, 2014. Move over Shark Week coming up August 10th. It's World War I week on the Tom Woods Show. Much more important than Shark Week, which my wife is a huge fan of, by the way. She's a big fan of Shark Week, so she took slight offense when on Facebook I said, all right, people, just forget about Shark Week. World War I week blows it out of the water, so to speak. Well, today, I'm telling you, this is going to be better than any shark show you've ever seen because we are welcoming Richard Gamble back to the show. Now, if you don't remember Richard Gamble being on the show, you may be a recent listener. We had Richard on in 2013, and remember, you can get a free ebook. I mean free. There ain't no string attached to this ebook of all the interviews we did in 2013, a veritable primer on liberty, and it's at my personal site, tomwoods.com. You have to go to tomwoods.com/woodsbook, all one word, tomwoods.com/woodsbook. You get a free ebook. Man, it's unbelievable the things you get just by listening in to this show. We talked to Richard last year, and now we've got him back because he is the author of a book that's so appropriate to talk about when we're talking about World War I. It's about the American experience, and it's called The War for Righteousness, Progressive Christianity, the Great War, and the Rise of the Messianic Nation. Richard's other books include the more recent title, In Search of the City on a Hill, The Making and Unmaking of an American Myth, and The Great Tradition, Classic Readings on What It Means to Be an Educated Human Being. Richard is Associate Professor of History and Anna Margaret Ross Alexander Chair in History and Political Science at Hillsdale College, where he also directs the Honors Program. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Whether or not you realize it, you are part of World War I week on the show. I'm doing all World War I related programming this week. We're going to have Bob Higgs talking about the domestic angle as far as the United States is concerned. We're going to have, oh goodness, we've had Hunt Tooley. We're going to have him back on. So it's a great week, and I thought, you know, who makes sense to invite this week? And I reviewed your book, The War for Righteousness, back, gosh, maybe it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, actually pushing 11 years.
Oh my goodness gracious. So I thought, right, this is a guy we have to talk to because this is a completely overlooked, neglected dimension of the war. I think a lot of people have a sense of what the social gospel movement was, and I bet they would conclude from what they know about it that these people would be, if not pacifists, then certainly anti-war. And what you did was to blast away at the casual assumptions that we might make in a situation like this. So let's start off with, what's the basic overview of what you're saying here in The War for Righteousness?
You have put your finger right on the puzzle that I encountered way back when I was in graduate school as to why these clergy, very prominent clergy in many cases, seminary professors, pastors of big urban churches, why they devoted so much time to world peace, internationalism, international law and justice, and humanitarianism, why they became some of the most jingoistic supporters of the war, why they pushed for intervention, why they were even way out ahead of the Wilson administration. And I couldn't put those pieces together, why professional peace advocates would become some of the greatest warmongers. And I looked at some of the theology behind that. I looked at the social gospel movement behind these clergy and traced their interventionism to an impulse to remake the world. These are frustrated reformers who wanted to remake American society, wanted to remake the American family, remake American politics, economics, and that impulse to remake things didn't stop at the nation's shores. And they had a vision for global transformation. And they, at first, some of them objected to the war. Some of them saw the war as a setback to world peace, as would be sensible, saw it as putting history in reverse, taking us away from a future of peace and prosperity and harmony. But then they fit the war into their ideology. You know, this was going to be a war for permanent peace. This was going to be a war for justice. This was going to be, as some said, you know, the final war, or the world to make the world safe for democracy, or, as H.G. Wells said in England in 1914, the war to end all wars. So if you can convince yourself that this is the ultimate war, the final war, then you can wage it as a war for righteousness and in this weird way, a war for perfect peace and a real boots-on-the-ground war become all one thing. And this is how they try to fit it together.
I'm going back and looking at some of the quotations that I picked out of this book years ago, and I'm just left speechless at the Orwellian language that's used. You quote a seminary professor as saying that, quote, pacifism does not mean passivity, and, quote, does not renounce physical force. Well, look, I'm sorry, but pacifism does renounce physical force. That's what the word means. And then it says that to remain neutral while Europe fought its own wars, quote, may have been justifiable for our nation in its infancy. It is not now. The pacifists do not advocate any such peace policy as that. Their motive is not safety but service. They would have ours not a hermit nation, but a humanitarian nation. So couldn't you say that their intentions were really good? And what really is the problem with bringing religion into this? They're trying to bring about righteousness in the world, and the Germans were in the wrong. Is there anything wrong with this? I mean, is there anything wrong with that whole way of thinking?
Well, it does sound noble, and I don't doubt that their intentions were good. They were idealistic, and sometimes we let idealists off the hook because of the power of their vision, the power of their ideas. But that is the very thing we need to focus on, and that's what even has relevance down to the 21st century. The intensity of that idealism, that longing for perfection here on Earth, that longing to end war in the world, to bring perfect justice and harmony and so on, that desire leads in a short step to total war, to the logic
right.
of total war. And that's the danger of a war for righteousness, that any means will be used at any cost for any length of time, because we have to reach that perfection. We're not there yet. So it brings that spiritual perfection, or tries to bring that spiritual perfection, that heavenly perfection, perfection here on earth, and to do it now, and to be in a hurry to realize it, to make it happen in the here and now on planet Earth. And it ends up with a bloodbath.
Well, of course, if you're going to use religious or Christian categories in particular in describing the war and the protagonists and antagonists, then you've got Christ on the one side and Satan on the other. You've got the American soldier or the U.S. Army as Christ on the cross, sacrificing itself for the world, and then you have Satan on the other side. if you're going to think of the war in those terms, of course you're going to have a total war as the result. Of course there's going to be no mercy shown. Of course all the values of the gospel will be thought of as nice little pious platitudes, but not really relevant when you're engaged in a conflict against the devil himself.
Right, and it speaks to some of the confusion we talked about the last time I was with you on the show, that confusion between the church and the government, the church and the state, and trying to transfer these ideals from one realm to the other, and trying to treat the whole world as if it were the church, the whole world as if it were the body of Christ. And that can sound, again, so noble, so good, so inspiring, but it insists on a perfection, on a level of holiness that is just too grand, too big for this world, too big for the world of practical politics and us mere mortals in this world. And what you've identified there as how we think of the enemy, how we imagine the enemy, what we call the enemy, what we call ourselves, and how we describe the war itself goes to the very core of the problem back in 1914 to 1918. It's a continuing bad habit down to the present day. We may not speak in quite as exaggerated terms today. I don't hear politicians going around saying America is the Christ of nations. I don't hear too much talk about the enemy being Satan, but that drive, that determination to make a war absolute, to bring an end, to bring a permanent peace to the Middle East, let's say, to bring a permanent peace to North Africa, to bring a permanent peace between Russia and its neighbors. That drive for permanent solutions here on this earth can get us into real trouble, and a disconnect between ends and means.
Well, you know, Richard, there is actually a famous or a not too uncommon bumper sticker that says that there are two people or two forces that have given up their lives for you, and one is Jesus Christ and the other is the American soldier. So there is the conflation and utter confusion. I mean, that is just so deeply wrong on so many levels. But I want to turn to the social gospel movement and in terms of what it was all about, because it looks in your high school textbook as if these are just a bunch of religious figures who want to support progressive reform. But they're doing so much more than that. They're redefining and remaking Christianity itself. When you read them, they have nothing but contempt for people who are concerned to save their souls and concern. They view that as antisocial individualism, that really what we need is not to think about saving your individual soul, but saving the world, making the world a better place, not thinking about going to heaven, but trying to make this world into a heaven. Washington Gladden had a book called Social Salvation, and that really sums it up, that salvation has nothing to do with individually saving your soul. That's so, you know, 3 years ago. Today, the cool people think salvation means a tougher railroad regulation. Now, how does that, this emphasis on salvation and the Christian method messages being a collective rather than an individual thing, does that feed into in any way their views on war and peace?
You know, it does, and in the book, that story takes a little while to tell, but we see it already in the Spanish-American War of 1898. We see that they're almost practicing during that war to talk about history backwards a little bit for a minute. It's almost as if that's a dress rehearsal for what they're going to do in 1917. But that breakdown of let me take one step back. That, as you said, the transferring of sin and evil from the human heart out into society, out into the institutions and the economic relations of society, that transfer is fundamentally important. To say that the war between good and evil, the war, the spiritual battle is not taking place in my heart, that redemption isn't about my salvation, but that it's about social redemption. That is so fundamental. And then we point the finger out there. We point the finger to everything around us and say, that's evil. And when we get rid of that evil in society, then we will be on the road to the kingdom of God on earth. When we get rid of that evil, so then warfare itself is identified as one more evil that has to be gotten out of the way. And then all this natural human goodness will be able to gush forth, and we will have world brotherhood and world peace. It can sound very naive, but there's also something very sinister underneath of it, because it puts the location of evil, it puts the location of the conflict between good and evil in the wrong place. It externalizes it, and it's just an easy step from waging, and this is their language, waging a domestic war for righteousness.
Mm.
Waging an international war for righteousness. They see those as two sides, two phases of one crusade to remake the world.
Yeah, in fact, you quote Christian Century as saying something exactly along those lines, that after the war, people basically will be accustomed to the idea that the state can call you into service to do some good. Well, maybe we could call you into domestic service to do some good. You quote from a book, Christian Internationalism, by the Reverend William P. Merrill. You quote him as saying this, "The best mark of a saved man," and he puts saved in quotation marks, "if a saved man is not that he wants to go to heaven, but that he is willing to go to China or to the battlefield in France or to the slums of the city or to the last dollar of his resources or to the limit of his energy to set forward the kingdom of God." And your commentary on this is, quote, "In Merrill's expansive ideal, there was apparently no distinction between personal redemption, social service, and enlistment in the United States Army."
Yeah. You can't make this stuff up.
No, exactly right, exactly right. All right, I've got some other great stuff, though, that I have one more quote. Yeah, now, I mean, there's just so much of this in here. Upton Sinclair, who is a socialist, said that as a result of the war, the churches would now be, quote, "inspired by things read not in ancient Hebrew texts, but in the daily newspapers," and that the individual minister, because he'd have experience with trench warfare, would emerge from the conflict, quote, "less the bigot and formalist ever after," because he would have had a lesson in, quote, "cooperation and social solidarity." And he says that he looks forward to the emergence of a church, quote, "redeemed by the spirit of brotherhood, the church which we socialists will join." Well, if it's a church which the socialists will join, that means that it's not the church anymore. That means that it has been transformed beyond recognition. And that clearly is what the social gospel was all about.
Right. It reinvented America's seminaries. It reinvented Christian colleges, it reinvented the churches, it reinvented mission boards, it reinvented all of it, and it used all the old language, and that's interesting about
right.
Putting the word saved in quotation marks. We now have to say the word saved with our fingers crossed.
Right, right, yeah, because we all know that's stupid superstition, you know, and today
right.
saved
right.
means, you know, passing more regulation through the Congress
right.
or something.
It's all with a wink and a nudge, and that's what they do to doctrine after doctrine. Every doctrine in the Apostles' Creed ends up with a quotation mark around it, because we now mean something very earthly, very temporal, very much about government power. And, you know, somewhere, and I wish I had it right in front of me, but maybe you can find the hymn that Merrill wrote.
Oh, I don't want to. Don't make me.
the line is that the making of man is the task of the state.
Oh!
And he wrote that well before the war.
Oh, my goodness. Now, all right, well, I do want to move on to what you had to say about this interesting new Richard Jenkins book, but I Philip Jenkins book, but I can't help asking, I don't know if this is something that you know off the top of your head, but when I come across these social gospel texts, it makes me wonder. This was such a sudden and coordinated movement, the social gospel. It makes me wonder, what were traditional Christian clergy doing at this time? How were they responding to this? Did they realize that there was a revolution taking place under their noses? Were they fighting back? Were they critical of these people? Were they saying, this is a bloody outrage, what they're trying to do to the Christian faith?
Right. They were, and that story isn't as well known as it needs to be. And there are a lot of there were a lot of traditional churches, traditional confessional Lutherans. There were traditional confessional Presbyterians, Episcopalians, some Roman Catholics, although the Catholic Church was split in its reaction to the war. So there were those who were alarmed at what was happening to the theology of the church, of how the church was being politicized, of how it was being mobilized for an agenda utterly alien to its identity. But we tend to focus on these progressive forces. Our history books are written to celebrate those who are innovative and are bringing transformation and those who are ushering in the future. And so we lose the story of those who were speaking out against this, who were raising the alarm against this.
All right, so let's now shift a minute. You had an article last month in the American Conservative, which I've had Dan McCarthy on the show. He's the editor. And it's called Was World War I the Last Crusade? And you're reviewing a book by Philip Jenkins called The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. So this is focused on the European side of things. What did you, what did he find? What did you point out that he found looking at this? Because I think a lot of people think that by the 20th century, European society is highly secular, so religion is not really a useful analytical category in examining World War I.
Right. And one major accomplishment of this book is that here we are 100 years after the war, and this is really the only book of its kind that takes an international perspective, a comparative perspective, and looks at the wide question of religion in the war, and even Islam in the war with the Ottoman Empire. And what Jenkins found, looking at popular culture, looking at the government, looking at the army, he found that religion was right there, immediately there in the experience of the people. It was prominent in the kind of, I want to say propaganda, but Jenkins is careful to show that it's not quite that cynical and manipulative, that there's something very natural about how the British, the French, the Germans reached very, very quickly for religious images, reach for religion as a way to explain what this war is all about, as a way to interpret their own experience of the war. And he shows how prevalent this was for the soldiers to talk about visions on the battlefield, to think about, of course, about their own spiritual condition, but to think about the implications of the war for religion and what religion was contributing to the war. And this is really the first attempt to look globally at this question, which is a hallmark of Jenkins scholarship anyway.
You say you're quoting here, as we examine the mainstream assumptions of the greatest churches at the time, we repeatedly see just how close to the surface of the Christian and biblical tradition such patterns of state alliance and militancy actually lie, and how easily ideas of the church militarist emerge in times of crisis. And, you know, this is all very, very sad and discouraging because when we look at, for example, the early church, there was a real desire to, you know, not to go out of their way to be targeted by the Roman Empire, but really to try to stay away from the armed forces, to try to focus themselves on living out the message of the gospel. And today, there is this sense that if you even so much as mention that there might be a Pacific way of reading the gospels, that there might have been a message in there against the use of violence, that you're some kind of pinko radical. And that's such a terrible shame to me.
I think what really gets lost, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, is the pilgrim identity of the church, the sojourning identity of the church, or maybe we could even say the exile identity of the church. Too often, Christianity and other religions as well, I mean, certainly Islam, identifies itself with very earthly, temporal causes, identifies itself with politics, identifies itself with a certain social agenda, whether that's left or right. And what gets lost is Christianity's sense that it is accountable to something much higher. It is accountable to something beyond this world. It is accountable to another kingdom. You know, Jesus told Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world." But there's something, there's that itch among a lot of Christians to be very much of this world. And that can mean the way they approach warfare, the way they approach politics, the kinds of questions and debates that they fill their day with, and the kinds of debates that they drag into their church, and they expect their pastor or priest to speak to the politics of the day rather than to teach about a kingdom yet to come.
Well, the book is The War for Righteousness, Progressive Christianity, the Great War, and the Rise of the Messianic Nation. I don't think there had been a book like this until you did it, nearly 100 years after the war, a very important story that, again, clouds what you would assume would be the story of American history, in which the people on the progressive left are in favor of peace, and then you have the right-wing militarists. But the progressive left, whether they were secular or at least nominally religious, as the progressive, as the social gospel people were, almost all of them jumped on board World War I. Just about all of them. You can count on one hand how many prominent progressives. You can think of Randolph Bourne. You can think of Jane Addams. But it's not very many prominent progressives who were against the war. So U.S. history is really a history of the idea of the Messianic Nation, and that is an idea in its secular or religious forms that has been embraced by almost everyone with consequences that have not been so good. And I'm grateful to you for your work as a historian of this important feature of American history. So I hope we can have you again. I mean, there are always topics like this in the news and stuff that you're writing about. Make sure and keep us in mind the next time you come out with something provocative. We want to get you back on.
I will. My next project is Julia Ward Howe and the Battle Hymn of the Republic.
Okay. Oh, we are so having you on for that.
I can tell you some hair-raising things.
We can't wait. Thanks a lot, Richard.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody. I want to tell you what's going on tomorrow. But first, August 15th, make sure and join me in Nashville, Tennessee, for the Night of Clarity. You can get the details on that at nightofclarity.com. Bob Murphy's speaking. David Stockman is speaking. If you are anywhere remotely near Nashville, and I mean by remotely near, I mean in the same hemisphere, then you got to be there at that thing. August 15th, we're going to have an absolutely fantastic time. David Stockman, for heaven's sake, plus Bob Murphy. I mean, without Bob Murphy, where would the Tom Woods Show be? So I hope you guys are there. I'm there basically every year, it looks like. Then October 25th, I've got an event in Boise, Idaho. I love Idaho. They have me all the time. Not all the time, but vastly out of proportion to their numbers. So Boise, Idaho, October 25th, save the date there. I'll have details up in the near future at tomwoods.com on the events page. Of course, you can stay posted on everything I'm up to and my writing and my homeschool courses and everything else with the newsletter at tomwoods.com. You can also get it at tomwoodsradio.com. Tomorrow we're talking to David Henderson, an economist who is at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and we're going to talk about the talk he gave, an economist's case for a non-interventionist foreign policy. Makes sense to talk about during World War I week. And he's speaking to a group of foreign Navy officers in a program sponsored by the Naval War College. So in other words, he's not delivering this speech to a group of Ron Paul supporters. So very interesting. We're going to talk about how that was received, what types of arguments he made tomorrow on World War I Week. Now, of course, if you want to learn real history, this is the show to listen to. World War I Week is great. But also, if you want to learn real history, make sure you subscribe to LibertyClassroom.com, where you can learn the history and economics they didn't teach you in courses taught by me and by other people you've heard on this program. You can listen to them in your car, become super-duper smart, effortlessly. With coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps, you get 50% off at LibertyClassroom.com. All right, David Henderson tomorrow, everybody. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.